All right, y'all. Welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. This is episode 82. And in an age of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Today, I have on a very good friend of mine, Matthew Arrett. Welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. Matt, how you doing, sir?
Always a great pleasure. And I'm doing good. And I'm looking forward to our chat.
So, okay, before we get started, everyone that comes on the Fearless Podcast gets a gift. Now, not sure what you're drinking there, but do you drink coffee?
I do. I'm a coffee aficionado. Yes.
All right. I think you're going to love it. So what we have here is we have our own coffee line, and we just revamped it. So we have three or four different roasts. And this is all organic. So we have a light, medium, and a dark roast. And then I can send you a whole bean or ground.
Whole bean, please.
Whole bean. Okay. So yeah. Are you a light roast, medium roast, or dark roast guy?
It really depends on the day and the season. So right now I'm in a light roast modality. Okay. So let's go with light roast if you got that.
Yeah, I think that is the... I don't know if that's the Dixieland or the Wide Awake, but I'll get that out to you. I'll get your mailing address and I'll get that to you. I thought one way we could kind of open up is maybe you could give us a little brief background on yourself.
Well, okay. Yeah, for sure, man. And thank you so much. Jeez, that's a sweet gift. Cool. Yeah, no, for myself, yeah, I guess people tend to call me a historian, but I didn't study history. It's not what I went to school for, and it's not what I saw myself doing 20 years ago when I was in university. I was more in the filmmaking arts orientation, and, you know, life and discoveries kind of can shake you up a little bit. And I made my own little political traumatic discoveries about, you know, everybody's gone through their own process. If they're watching your show, they know what I'm talking about. So the choice is to either, you know, dig your head in the sand and pretend you didn't just see that, or to you could do the other thing and actually start, you know, questioning your own axioms and really going inside to self-examine how much you want to keep, how much you got to throw away, because we're born into a system that was already pretty corrupt before we were even brought into this world. So, you know, goes without saying, we gotta do a lot of self-examining to think like how much of my thoughts, my impulses are my own that I generated, and how much were part of the conditioning that was designed to enslave my society that I just happened to, like, you know, just stuck on you, you know? So anyway, I found myself doing a lot of research. I became a political activist at a certain point, did that for about 10 years with the LaRouche organization. They had a branch in Canada, which is where I live. So that was sort of my real world schooling training. I found, just doing that thorough, you know, in terms of trying to like organize to resist the New World Order. And that was back in 2006. I got serious on that. And in that process, I was trying to piece together what is Canada. So I found myself doing a lot of research with a few of my colleagues. And we made a lot of discoveries about the weird thing that is this construct called Canada. And this involved going back to 1776 and how we failed to become an ally of the 13 colonies when we were invited by Ben Franklin to join as the 14th colony. There was a lot of corruption, a lot of Jesuitical manipulation that kept us locked into the British crown. Oh, you still there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, cool. So that was a mind-blowing set of discoveries, and it manifested in a lot of magazine. I started publishing a magazine around 2012, and because I couldn't find anyone who would want to publish this kind of material. So I was like, well, I guess we have to do it ourselves. So I started publishing that, and that became the content for a 4-volume book series that I called the Untold History of Canada. And then following up on that 4-volume sort of reconstruction of all of Canadian history, which was a fun project, I decided to do another 4-volume series over the next few years, sort of outlining the origins of the deep state. Like, what is this thing that's latched onto the United States and that's killed America's presidents, the good ones at least, going back again over 2 centuries? So that was a fun ride as well. And each you know, each set of discoveries gives you a new set of hypotheses about what is this oligarchy that's currently trying to move us into a very bad place. What are they afraid of? So anyway, I all that to say, the platform I created was called the Canadian Patriot Review, and that still exists, and that's still a geopolitical platform. We make movies as well nowadays. My wife and I began the Rising Tide Foundation, so it's sort of a more cultural, educational platform to deal with the corruption of our education system. And we did that back in 2019, and that's going strong. And more recently, I launched a project with a friend who's a nuclear physicist from Russia, named Dr. Edward Lazansky, and that's called the Academy for International Cooperation. So it's a new pilot project we just launched like a month and a half ago to try to get some constructive dialogue around what do we do? What do we do? So we're in this terrible place as a civilization. It could get really dark. So what pathways are available with an understanding of what has worked in the past that could apply towards looking to the future? That's just a few of the things that I'm up to.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you're not busy, but anyway, yeah. if you want to get something done, you give it to a busy person that is productive. And that's what I've experienced in life. So it's great to have you on. What kind of generated my contact for reaching out to you? Because I get your newsletter. You released an article about breaking Wall Street, right? And this is like in my wheelhouse because a little bit of my background, you know, went to college for finance, became a financial advisor. So the first half of my professional career was in financial advising. And so I got to experience the dot-com bubble, and then I got to experience the 08 bubble. And that's actually how I ended up getting, by the grace of God, I got forced out of the financial industry. I didn't want to participate anymore. And because of different things that I found there with doing stock and mutual fund analysis and a lot of the chicanery that was going on. So I kind of got forced out and I liquidated everything out of the market in 08. We strategically relocated to Texas in 2014. And now I'm like, well, you know, the modern day paradigm with, you know, retirement and investing all revolves around Wall Street. And I had developed an opinion from my experiences. I'm like, all I see is this entire Wall Street apparatus is just a way to redistribute wealth, you know? And then, so then I'm like, well, if I'm not investing in conventional methods, like, what do I do? Like, you know, because you're supposed to do this. And obviously, you want to build and grow a living legacy. That was another goal we had as a family. And if I'm not conventionally investing, what do I do? So I came up with this idea of investing in infrastructure and dirt and fruit trees and cows. And I coined this term food 401k. And so we kind of have that kind of stuff on our website and teaching people how to propagate fruit trees and grow their own stuff and, you know, cows and the carnivore diet, all these different modalities. And, you know, we built a greenhouse. And so we did all this stuff, you know, and I looked at that. I allocated funds monthly, roughly say 10%, that we're going to invest in infrastructure, whether it's a tractor or what have you. So I started investing that way. And because I'm like, okay, we want to invest in the future. We want to continue to build and grow and do all these things. So then we kind of did all that. And that kind of reaches a tipping point where, I mean, you can always add infrastructure. You can always buy infrastructure and heavy equipment and different things like that. But then we progressed past that. And then I'm like, okay, now what do I do? Because now we're debt free. You know, we have all this stuff bought and paid for. We have this infrastructure. We're continuing to work on that. But now I have to do something different. And this is why I want to get into this topic of breaking Wall Street, because I think it's critical. Because one thing that I point out to people, right, is we know these usual suspects like Blackstone, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, right? And if you dig down into the numbers, like someone like Ian Carroll, right, who digs down into the numbers, and what you end up finding out is that all of these publicly traded companies are, relatively speaking, now all derivatives, basically, of these big four or five: Vanguard, State Street, BlackRock, Blackstone, and all those different things. And so, like, by outsourcing your investment to Wall Street, it's so consolidated that you're putting your financial future into the hands of these top five mega corporations that are transferring your wealth, which is why during the pandemic we saw this exponential growth of the top 1% while we were locked down, and while we couldn't do things and couldn't buy stuff, and while a lot of people lost their jobs, lost their sources of income, we still saw this just gigantic wealth redistribution. So that's basically my view of Wall Street. So I wanted to kind of dive into this topic of breaking Wall Street, why it must be broken, and then maybe potentially offer solutions. I think that's the beauty of everything you're doing. You know, we all go down the rabbit hole, right? And you see all this stuff, and it's big, hairy, fuzzy, and scary, you know, Sasquatch size problems. And, you know, nobody can find Sasquatch, you know, that's the problem. And, but it's because he can cloak and do all that. But anyway, but in the meantime, though, we still have to live and grow and have success and have hope. So we need solutions. And that, you know, that's the beauty of what you're doing, is you can't just point out the problem without coming up with solutions. And then what we've done is financially, I've started working with a group of other people and families, and how do we develop a parallel system, right? So that we can still get a rate of return and a return on investment, but how can we do that outside of the current monetary system we have? And so maybe if you want to just jump into one, why do we need to break down Wall Street? And then, you know, what are some potential viable, how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, that's where I'll put the historian hat on, I guess, because I felt the need to publish this piece of analysis I did some years back. I retweaked it a little bit, you know, based on the fact that there's obviously a certain dialogue and discussion that's capable of happening now, and that is happening now because of the new incoming administration of Trump 2.0. So there's obviously conversations that couldn't have been had if, you know, completely Borg liberal technocrats are running the show. You just can't even go there conversationally. So now, at the very least, this spectrum of what can be talked about has widened in a constructive way. Whether or not Trump actually has the wherewithal and capacity and the collaborators with the wits and insights needed to carry out this type of battle, I don't know. I'm going to leave it open. But, you know, I figured it's a good time to reissue some of these considerations now. And for those who would like to, I guess I'll just say this as an addendum, but for those who would like to maybe dig in a little bit more detail-wise into this material of how this was done before, like at what points do we have case studies and history lessons that can be gleaned upon to see where did these Wall Street banks, that it's not like a new thing that, oh, in the last 10, 20, 30 years, they just came to power. It's like, no, that's like the story of the entirety of the American story, is the Battle of Patriots versus this parasitical financial banking class that has no allegiance to the nation, its people, or anything. It sees itself or those representing it tend to see themselves, if anything, kind of like a higher species. It's a very Ubermenschian, like perverse philosophy. And when you really start getting down to it, you start seeing that this parasite is actually not in no way. They don't mind using the structures and instruments of so-called American things to their advantage. The American military and other things that allow for the projection of power onto American people or other people around the world. They don't mind that. But the actual entity itself is really the same British Empire oligarchy that the founding fathers broke away from. It's the same families, the same ruling black nobility families that are still interbreeding with each other in Europe to this day, that still are there and that were there, you know, 250 years ago. They were there 1,000 years ago. And in fact, some of these core families, you could even trace back to the Roman patrician class that ran Rome into the ground, that expanded it into a corrupt, evil empire, that just rotted and collapsed under the weight of its own self-contradictions back, you know, 1800 years ago. So you're dealing with something that's not all that unique. I said 1800 years, I should say 1600 years, but whatever. It's not a unique thing. So again, what is it afraid of? And in the essay that caught your attention that we're going to talk about a little bit is dealing with how did the one of the more recent attempts at a banker's new world order, how did it fail? How did patriots mobilize and wield the powers that are there within the Constitution of the United States to effectively carry out a battle which has been nearly written out of the record? Most people have no connection intellectually to what was done back in 1932, 33, 34. They don't know. It's been banalized, oversimplified, distorted to the point that the actual story that's right there in front of our face is not seeable for most people looking at it because of the various assumptions that have been baked into our historical analysis or how we're conditioned to look at our past with what assumptions. We can't see it, or so many people can't. So I tried to make the story that I understand it as clear as possible. And that began with, why did America not get broken and was not destroyed with the Great Depression of 1929? So if you were living in 1931, 32, 33, you might have said, okay, statistically the US doesn't stand a chance. It's every year is worse and worse. The wealth transfer was crazy, because I mean the bankers who initiated the Great Depression back in 29, they were all tied to the JP Morgan preferred clients list. So it was like an inside job to blow out the economy after they blew up. They created these bubbles and bubbles with broker call loans that far outpaced the actual GDP or any part of the physical economy, that, you know, that brokers were just taking loans out to make more bets, utilizing as equity their access to people's savings. The clean part of the commercial banks were being accessed to speculate upon, ironically, in real estate was a driving force back then too. So at a certain point, there was a concerted effort, and you know, they won't tell you this necessarily in, I guess, mainstream university courses, but it's discoverable, it's a fact, it's truthful, that there was a coordinated broker call loan where everybody in the inside said, or in the know, said, okay, we're going to, I don't know if it was a Tuesday or Friday or whatever, in October of 29, said, we're going to call in, we're going to make all these brokers pay back the money that they owe. They don't have it, but we know that they can't pay it. So we know that that's going to trigger a wave of defaults that's going to spiral out of control. We know that. And they, for those in the know, they were able to sell off right before the bubble was burst with the pinprick. Their
like
various
FTX. Holdings. Sounds like Sam Bankman-Fried and the whole Bitcoin scam that is FTX.
Exactly. It's an old trick, always works. This is what was done back in the tulip bubble in Amsterdam, you know, in the 1680s or something. You had a tulip mm-hmm. bubble. Same thing, though. It was a big wealth transfer for those who cultivated the bubble, where people were trading castles for tulips or tulip certificates. And then, you know, it was a big joke for most people who got sucked into it. And so that's what was happening. And those who were then buying up for pennies on the dollar, the foreclosed farms, the industries, they weren't trying to make money with their new acquisitions of farmland and industry. They were actually accelerating the shutdown of America's agricultural production and industrial production. So you had the industrial index between 29 and 33 collapsed by 70%. Farming was being massacred by design. So the people were being slaughtered for, I mean, and I love what you're doing with the family. It's kind of like a microcosm of what a healthy economy should be. You're like a proof of principle, just demonstrating, okay, well, what works in the large should also work in the small. And if it works in the small, it should also work in the large. And it's like, yeah, money is an invention. It should be obedience to the needs of something higher that humans do, which is exactly what you've outlined. So that's what the oligarchy understands in a certain way, but they because they're misanthropic, like their characteristic is to hate humans because they see us as a virus. They see themselves as another higher species to control a lower order, you know, class of unwashed, the great unwashed, you know. They try to create conditions of scarcity that they get us to adapt into. They don't like it when human beings think creatively and create abundance. They don't like that. So all that to say, that was the Great Depression. So why did we get out of that? What was the battle? And so I tried to get across that as best as I could in my books and in the article for what did FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, what did he actually do? Who came in with him? Who was he working with? From both parties, who were patriots, who were able to work together against the Wall Street banks. Was there a fight? Yeah, there was. How did it go down? Who died? Who got assassinated? What about the city of London? Was there a fight with those bankers who also were trying to get a one world government to solve the Great Depression in 1933, which they were under the London Banking and Economics Conference? They were. It was an attempt to create a League of Nations run, Bank of England managed, one world government to replace nation states, and it failed. I only found out about that. This should be known by every kid by the age of grade two. I had to like do my digging and discover that was the case, and it only failed because FDR sabotaged the conference. He pulled out the U.S. delegations. They jettisoned the thing, and then he began at the same time to launch his war against the Wall Street banks, and he had things like the what's known as the Pecora Commission, which is the core theme of that essay that you read. So I tried to go through, well, who was Pecora? Who was Ferdinand Pecora? How was he empowered by Franklin Roosevelt to go and force these leading bankers from the top Wall Street banks into court to prove how they orchestrated the Great Depression by short-selling their own bank stock, which is what several of them did and went to jail for it. He brought in John Pierpont Morgan Jr. He forced him into court through Pecora, and actually thousands of bankers were forced to like be audited. Their books were forced to be opened, where they were forced to show to the world how they orchestrated the Great Depression, how they benefited from that. And so it was a huge fight that just was needed to create the space in order to rally or revive the powers of the Constitution to get control over the institutions that the Federal Reserve had come to dominate. And FDR did that through a number of ways, which we can talk about today if you'd like. But yeah, that was the idea. And I want to try to use this intelligence, this information, to hopefully color and improve the quality of creative discussions that are happening and people around Trump who might have a say in going about a strategy for a new policy for America faced with the current economic collapse that's being set up to tank the American economy, which is a time bomb. It's designed to blow. So before that happens, the choice is going to be whether we put the pain on the people and just unleash general chaos, or whether we focus the pain on those same Wall Street speculators who could take it themselves and then protect the real economy and the clean commercial banks and things that are tied to people's savings and food production. Can we save that and then just let the cancer part blow up onto itself? And I'm hoping we can do that, you know?
And that's the beauty, you know, because it's always like a three-legged stool, because we do, obviously, we are citizens, right? And we want to participate as a citizen in the whole process. And even if the administration has the capability and the wherewithal to keep their promises and do these different things simultaneously as families and as communities and on the smaller scale, we can create our own type of financial fortresses and our own type of exchange where we can put the political pressure on the they, them, and those and the power brokers and not just pin all of our hopes and dreams and future on that, participate in that while simultaneously developing our own personal capitalization and infrastructure so that depending on which way the administration goes, it's still like all hope is still not lost if they just make a bunch of empty promises and don't perform.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's not an either or thing. I think a lot of people, they get too sucked into this. Yeah, this one extreme of top down thinking only and or inversely only bottom up thinking. And these extremes never work. Like the oligarchy loves it when we get into these either or binaries. And it's like, well, can't you do both at the same time and protect right. and ensure as much as you can your family and community's safety and security as much as possible while sure. at the same time actively organizing as citizens for policies that affect the whole of the nation? I don't see why that can't be simultaneously done. So for sure. And, you know, like, I don't know, like what there is a discussion to restore the protective tariff. That's cool. I'm happy that there's that discussion. Every nation needs to have a protective tariff. That's the only way we've ever grown is through the protective tariff. But you don't want to make it a fetish either, like some mathematical magic wand where just by having, you know, 60% tariffs on Chinese goods incoming, all of a sudden that's going to make the economy better. It's like, well, no, there's a lot of other variables at play. And number one, we've hollowed out our productive base for 60 years. That includes also basic capacities that we once had that we've lost to build things that we once could build and we can't build anymore. We haven't built a hydroelectric dam now in 40 years. So we're good at demolishing them to liberate deserts and rivers, but building a new one, we haven't done that. So that's not easy. That takes many years of capacity building again to learn what we've forgotten. Nuclear power, they're talking about getting nuclear power back online a little bit. But it's like, well, all of the actual nuclear engineers and scientists who built it, because, you know, America has a lot, Canada has a lot, but it was all built up before 1981. They're mostly long retired or dead. So the people with living memory aren't there anymore. So it's nice to have the will, but without the means, it's not really going to go far. So you have to have like a much more non-mathematical approach to thinking about economy and a much more a better appreciation for the culture, the minds, the cognition, the physical economy, the physical production that people have just lost a focus of what that is because they've been so fetishized around monetary theories now for so many generations that they forgot the basic elementary fundamentals of like, how does food happen? How do you turn a resource into something usable? You know, like it's basic science of what sustains life is just not present in the most educated part of the people who would be expected to carry on those responsibilities. So I look for who has that knowledge and do I see them around Trump? And I don't see them around Trump. I think Trump is a builder. I think he's got an appreciation for how things get built. So he has got good instincts maybe on that level, but it's not like one person can do this. So, you know, like there are things that could be learned pretty easily and rapidly. If you look at this history and look at what did JFK do for his industrial tax credit system, for his projects for organizing hydroelectric dams in America that were driving industrial progress, how was he reviving in his way, in a self-conscious way? And he put this into words, the New Deal policy that he was a young man watching, seeing transform America, which was not about worshiping money. It was like the New Deal, if you look at it. And I tried to do like a little bit of an assessment, a breakdown of like what this was after Glass-Steagall could happen, because it couldn't have happened. You couldn't do the 45,000 infrastructure projects in America between 1933 and 39. Before America got into the war, there was 45,000 big and small infrastructure projects. Some were really big. Like those are the ones that were kind of like driving the thrust, but as secondary, tertiary projects, you know, you had the the Hoover Dam, you had the Grand Coulee Dam system, you had the St. Lawrence Seaway projects, you had the Tennessee Valley Authority and the rural electrification projects. And I mean, just taking the time to map it out, seeing what was the amount of organizational skill required to transform the Tennessee Valley area, which was like hillbilly land of illiteracy was up pushing 80% in 1932. Huge illiteracy, you know, and then to see that by 1950, this was the aerospace hub of the world with an illiteracy down to 5%. Like, that quality of transformation in only 18 years is astounding. And they did it because all of a sudden you have, like, what, 70 hydroelectric dams, new water diversion projects, capture reservoirs, new technologies being introduced into farming that are giving people who were formerly, like, you know, maybe using a donkey or a, you know, a cow and a backhoe, but all of a sudden you have, like, technology being encouraged, which requires more cognition from the practitioner. That was a big deal, and higher living standards come with that, you know, greater abundance. So you have all of these things, but that could only happen, these 45,000 projects, big and small, if you first were able to carry out the political fight involving Glass-Steagall, which Trump talked about in 2016. He talked about it again in 2017, and then I don't know what happened. He made compromises, was told to shut up about that, and he stopped talking about that. But it's like, for me, I look at Glass-Steagall, and that was like, I mentioned that FDR had to sabotage this London Bankers Conference, but to carry out the fight with Wall Street, he had to do on the one hand, do the PCORA Commission to prove how these bankers manufactured the crisis. But then number two, once that was done, you still had the crisis. You still had 26% of the U.S. banks that were completely bankrupt, insolvent. You know, people were pulling all of their cash out of the banks. There was no faith in the system at all, whether domestically or internationally. Nobody wanted to buy U.S. bonds. Why would you want to? The U.S. is tanking. So you have no means of emitting credit. So he had to do Glass-Steagall. So the Glass-Steagall Act was really important, originally in 33, in March, I think, 13th, 33, which called for the breaking up of commercial banking activities, which would be kept completely separated from investment banking and speculation that could not be cross-contaminated. And in that sense, he was able, when you did that audit and figured out what was clean, what was not clean, you could then, that was part of the two-week banking holiday, was do the assessment, you know, then recapitalize whichever banks were viable under new management. You had to clean out a lot of management, bringing people who are competent, and then start lending to the real economy. And that required, you know, a sense of a long-term vision. Where there's no vision, the people perish. So you have to have an idea that, okay, the credit system is now going to have to be wired not for the speculators. And you had things like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. So FDR was not able to get the Federal Reserve to cooperate to loan the money to the real economy. They wouldn't want to. They were, in fact, retracting the money supply as much as they could. So he had to create take over the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and use it kind of like a national bank, the way Lincoln was able to use the greenback. So the national banking system that Lincoln was able to consolidate to the degree he could before he was murdered, that was then able to issue the greenbacks that were tied to building the Continental Railway, all of these infrastructure projects during and after the Civil War, until the Wall Street banks zapped it all up. They annihilated the greenbacks by 1871, but that was revived by FDR in a self-conscious way. They were self-referring to the lessons of Lincoln when they were bringing in the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to start lending, which it became the number one lender to the real economy beyond all of the Wall Street banks by 1939-40. And through there, you know, you had things like, again, the Tennessee Valley Authority that could itself create sub-corporations that were under the control and influence of the Constitution of America, that could do sub-lending, almost like national, again, like an organized subsection of national banks operating under the idea of the Constitution and the general welfare of the society. And schools were changed, like curriculums were completely revolutionized in the 30s and 40s around the new understanding of what banking should be about as a function of the moral development of society. You could read these textbooks from high school economics classes in 1937, 38. I got a couple from 42 in my bookshelf. And it's it's like a breath of fresh air. It's like, why is what makes human beings different from animals? that's like chapter one of like macroeconomics textbooks in high school, you know? And then like, how do we increase food production? How should money serve that? You know, like it's common sense, elementary stuff. And it's great to watch, but we lost it. So it kind of hurts as well to read that and see what we lost. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and history is always why history is so fascinating and interesting is because, you know, you learn or you're programmed or whatever in whatever the new Keynesian economic theory is, you know, and they delete history or revise it so because it doesn't fit their narrative, you know, and that's mm-hmm. why all this information is so important. And it's just fascinating because that's kind of where all these rabbit holes start and stop. You're like, wait a minute, you know, and I think the really important point of what I see is when you see these gigantic wealth transfers and the way that economies are tanked, the larger grand solution is like, well, the easiest way, historically, you know, the easiest way to get out of this is just, you know, have another world war. And then if, you know, if we have another world war, then it'll create all of this economy. And it would be really nice if we could find solutions before the only option is another world war to fix all of our financial woes.
Yeah, man, absolutely. It's a concern, right? Like whenever the economy's in a really bad place, the choices are people are problem solvers. Like we naturally, when it becomes clear that we're underwater, we will maybe we could adapt to being underwater for a while, and maybe we could be lied to and brainwashed into thinking that we're fish, and maybe for a little while it'll work. But at a certain point, the lack of oxygen gets visceral. And when that crisis moment hits where people start thinking, maybe I'm not a fish, maybe yeah. They look for the surface of the water. They look for oxygen, you know? So the natural instincts of human beings is to problem solve, to put out the fire when even if you thought that there's no fire, all of a sudden you're like, okay, it burns. You know, it's getting smells smoky. And then you're like, well, where's the water? What do you do? How do we get out of this burning house? So at that point, there's always a bit of a race where I think you've got the oligarchy, which are usually those arsonists who made the fire or pushed us underwater in the first place, who are then like racing to kick over the game board and to try to create just unmitigated, unmanageable crisis. Usually war is a really great way of getting it that fast, you know, that has the twofold advantage of giving people an enemy to rally around instead of the actual arsonists themselves. All of a sudden yeah. we're sold some enemy, whether it's the Russians, the Iranians, the Jews, the Chinese, like, and we're seeing this today, right? Like kind of a bit of all of that is coming at us in the propaganda machine, all sorts of narratives for each one of these different, you know, enemies of America to give us to hate and fear. So we're not really paying attention to the thing that did 9/11, that killed JFK, that you know, that's been there the whole time, like running the CIA and killing our presidents. We're not paying attention to that. And so on the one hand, yeah, you got that. And the other hand, yeah, like they find an excuse to just reset all and erase all of the unpayable debts and other things that were tanking the system and they could try to create some new system like they tried to do with World War One. The point of World War One was in many ways to just reset the system to create a new economy based on what was the solution of World War One, a war that had no purpose, which was, you know, I mean, the League of Nations, get rid of nation states and we'll have a one world government under a League of Nations. And John Maynard Keynes was a big promoter of that. And will nations cause wars? Look, we had nations. They made World War One happen. So maybe if we get rid of nations, we won't have wars anymore. And we'll have a big, you know, kumbaya. And people didn't buy it. You had President Harding as sort of the last Lincoln president who fought against it. You had Senator Norbeck and many of those same people who survived, even though they murdered Harding. And they did murder Harding. They say he was poisoned by oysters or something, or food poisoning. It's poisoning. But he sabotaged the League of Nations, him and his allies, from both parties, and those who survived him went on. They lost a little bit as Wall Street took more control over the American economy. You had the Roaring Twenties in that wake. And they went for New World Order attempt number two. Again, John Maynard Keynes was overseeing the London Bankers Conference in 32, 33 to solve the Great Depression. And when that didn't work, they pushed for World War II. They were like, okay, well, we didn't break their will enough in World War I. We got to break it even more. So they did. And, you know, it almost succeeded in another one world government run by a fascist New World Order and a eugenics class that became transhumanist later on, but they were still calling themselves eugenicists to, breed out the unfit and reduce the world population to acceptable levels for the elite to manage under, again, Nazism, fascism. And they tried that. It was the Nazis came to power because they had a lot of funding from Prescott Bush, and the DuPonts and the Harrimans and the Rockefeller Standard Oil Trust was completely backing fascism, and they were also funding the murder of FDR. He had survived an assassination attempt in 33, February 33. There was a murder, an anarchist Freemason who was sent out to kill FDR, and a woman in the audience ended up seeing the guy pull out his gun, hit his hand, and he ends up shooting the mayor of Chicago, who was standing right next to FDR, and he dies. But they tried again with the business coup that you and I talked about with your son last year. So that was another effort to create a Wall Street pro-fascist apparatus controlling America over FDR's dead body, while they were also helping to grow the fascist beast in, across the ocean. So, you know, there are all of these things and parts in motion, and they're doing it again today. Like, you could see the effort to accelerate towards war, to try to just reset the system, organize the chaos, create a new type of economy based upon the crap that Mario Draghi or Mark Carney are talking about, as far as like a new Green New Deal economy with new values tied to the behavior of money that will be tied to how much you can shut down your carbon, reduce your emissions, reduce your footprint, basically kill yourself to make money for an overlord class that's going to own things that you might be allowed to rent if your social credit score is adequate. You know, like, that's the type of ideal they want to get. But people are not just going to accept that, so they got to do other things to try to psyop us into taking that poison. But yeah, it's annoying.
Yeah, do you think, because with all the different solutions they float out there with Doge and efficiency and all this stuff, the underlying factor that I see is the quantitative easing and the money printing apparatus, the only way to truly fix our economy is to extract this liquidity that is in the, no one even knows the trillions or maybe tens or maybe hundreds of trillions of dollars through the quantitative easing and the book ledger stuff that they're doing with the buying back the bonds that the Fed is doing. Will any politician or even small faction of politicians, I mean, the only one that I know of in America that speaks to it is Thomas Massey, but will any politician ever, because just like you were saying, you know, there has to be pain somewhere, and the most controllable pain would be the removal of liquidity from our economy, which will make things suck really bad, but probably for an incredibly short period of time, maybe 6 months, 6 to 12 months. But I can't imagine any politician that would be willing to take the collateral damage of just the democracy and the consensus that, you know, we're so coddled as Americans, and we really don't appreciate the quality of life that we have, and nobody wants to take that hit of just the extraction of this overprinted money. That's just what I see is, you know, if we can extract this money from the system, it's the only way we're going to be able to stabilize the economy so that we can use sound financial ideas to make any types of improvement.
Yeah, I mean, I see it as like surgery, you know, like you're in a metastasized cancer that's been taken over through our own neglect. We've been treating the cancer as if it was the economy, growing this thing, and now it's terminal. Like it's a near terminal case where there's still some healthy tissue. There's a patient that can be saved. Of course, it's a metaphor, right? But that's how I'm thinking about it. So it does require some serious axiomatic rethinking about what was the economy in the first place that we thought it was because we were wrong. We know we're wrong because it's now kaput. So how do we do surgery on the cancer and then start a rehabilitation process of the healthy tissue so that we can get back to health? And that's a transgenerational way of thinking. That was transgenerational to get here. It's going to be and it's easier to break things than to make something new. So it took several generations to break it to this extent. So you have to allow yourself to think even longer in terms of a proper healing process in the deeper sense. Cause yeah, we can do things, to physically deal with the crisis in a lot of ways, but then the spiritual, intellectual self-sabotage we've done to ourselves, that's going to take some time. That's going to take a lot of time. So like, I think that when I look at, there's a quote, I actually wrote it down. It was such a good quote from one of, Ferdinand Pecora, the attorney who was sanctioned to take on the Wall Street banks. He had an ally who was one of his big sponsors named Senator Burton Wheeler. And Burton Wheeler said, the best way to restore confidence in our banks is to take these crooked presidents out of the banks and treat them the same way we treated Al Capone. And it was a good concept. And it's, I think if people actually saw, because I think one banker, a low-level dude in 2008, went to jail. Nobody got punished for the completely, like, the blatant crimes of Wall Street. Nobody got punished. There's no sense of justice in the hearts of Americans that justice exists in the system or is even possible. So that because they have no confidence, you know, they don't have any faith in the system, there's not much. If you don't earn that faith by actually getting a change in policy, there's not much that can be done. So I think that, like I said, part of the audit of the like, there's so much liquidity, there's so much quantitative easing, money printing out of thin air, baked into the system, the derivatives themselves that we've been saving. I don't even know of an economist that knows how to tell me what is the quantity of derivatives that are even baked into the system at this point? I get so many varying estimates from people who should know, ranging from 700 trillion to 1.9 quadrillion, some say, and I don't know. I mean, they don't seem to know. So how is it that we have these things that we've been bailing out that we don't even know how much they are because they're like so ephemeral and abstract of like, I don't know, you were in the system. Like, what's a derivative? If somebody asks you, what do you tell them? What is a derivative? What is your answer for these people?
Well, and now they've derivativized derivatives. So now there's derivatives of derivatives. Now, in 2020, they eliminated the fractional reserve. So there isn't even there's no type of bank reserve required at all. So, right. I mean, and that just exponentially compounds all this derivative stuff and the numbers are so enormous that we really can't even fathom them, you know, and part of that comes with like what you were speaking about is education and re-educating people and understanding what caused the problem to begin with. And then only once you understand the problem can you then build a way, even if it's a 50-year plan or a 100-year plan, but you have to be able to quantify it first so then you can at least break it down to say, okay, well, the number is X and, you know, we can free up or we can make this so efficient that we can save this much expenditure, and if we apply that over here in 50 years or 100 years or whatever, we'll be caught up, or you know, we'll be able to resolve this this monetary printing press that's just completely out of control.
Yeah, man. No, I agree. Yeah, it was. It's again this transgenerational thinking that we once took for granted, and we've really lost a sense of that. Like, what is real value? It takes time and patience. You know, you might want to plant the seed and come back the next day and all of a sudden get your corn, but fact is, you will have to wait and treat, you know, the process with a lot of patience and knowledge if you're going to be able to reap the harvest. And I think, like, today, like, we're in a situation where I see good things. Like, there's good discussions that I'm hearing as far as a sensitivity for the first time on the need to retool our rust belt, you know, the idea that, okay, it was a mistake to allow for Philadelphia and Detroit and Windsor, Ontario to be shut down, which was the consequence of exporting, externalizing our industries to cheaper markets for our dollar stores and our Walmarts to be the new basis of our consumer economy cult. That was a bad idea. So, you know, I hear Trump talking about the need to retool and rebuild the industrial base of these once super industrial powerhouses, which would be awesome if that could, and it has to be done. But Wall Street won't allow that to be done. They will, I mean, there's trillions of dollars permissible to be printed to bail out fake assets. But as far as, it would be a fraction of that, monetarily speaking, to provide for high quality water infrastructure for everybody. Low cost, high quality education can be provided to every student across America for like $100 billion if you actually, maybe a couple $100 billion, but still, like, very compared to what we've been doing to bomb countries back to the Stone Age in the Middle East, or printing just to like bail out speculators, and it's a fraction of a nothing. Or to build the North American water and power lines that JFK and Bobby Kennedy were advocating. That was a continental water project that would have greened by 1980 all of California by now, replenished the Ogallala aquifers, would have greened Texas and northern Mexico, and provided something like 80 gigawatts of electricity along the way by moving some of that waste, the excess water runoff from the north down south into the continent. That type of thinking could have been done several times over by 1980. Or no, could have been done one time over by 1980, several times over by today. And we chose to go in the other direction. So if it's like, what would be required to do big things like that again today? Well, one, you got to clean out the banks. Like you said, you got to erase a lot of this unpayable liquidity. Don't pretend that these derivatives are bailoutable. They're not. They should be deleted because they only exist on computer screens as ones and zeros. There's no corollary of any positive real value in the real economy. It doesn't exist. It's an overall net negative if you treat them as though they exist. So don't kill yourself to save these numbers. You can hit delete, which would again require a fight because people will die to protect those numbers. But then at the same time, when you have a more clear-headed idea of like, okay, where is the real value? Where is it not? Then you could start reorganizing the banks around a proper strategy. I mean, look at how would we then create a new kind of credit? Like in the case of Canada, there was this thing called there was a fight in 1959 under John Diefenbaker, who was a good guy. He was an admirer of Lincoln and FDR, and he was a prime minister of Canada, and he was coming in during a credit crunch, a saboteur operation in Ottawa. So there was no money, though he had a vision. He was elected because he had a vision and no one else did, for opening up the Arctic to new science cities, industrial cities, roads to resources. Like, it was a beautiful vision. I've read the reports. I saw the engineering feasibility studies. It's applicable. It could be started tomorrow. And he had a better, because he studied FDR, he studied Lincoln, he had a good understanding of the principle of how this works. And he fought to take hold of the Bank of Canada, which was it's a public bank. He wanted to use it as an instrument, not just to like manipulate interest rates, which is how it's been used by the Keynesians, these Keynesian monetarists that only see a national bank as a privately run central bank, separate from the political system, to be an independent thing manipulating the interest rates, which is just a weapon to keep nations in a cage. But he said, no, we can use this as an instrument to emit the credit for providing loans to entrepreneurs, to businesses that will take part in this grand, you know, 20-year project of opening up the Arctic as the new manifest destiny frontier of the North. And it was a beautiful idea. And his idea was to take these defunct, matured victory bonds that were issued in World War II. This is, again, 1959. So people were seeing their victory bonds matured. They wanted to cash them in, but there wasn't any money to give to people. So what, are you going to lie to them? No, I mean, or are you going to like collapse the economy even more by just cashing in, like in giving out cash that you don't even have, going more into debt when you're already in a recession? Well, his idea was to issue new, what he called conversion bonds. So convert your bond into a new kind of bond that would now be tied to opening up the Arctic, right? Building all these things. So every individual investor in America or Canada would get a personal payback of a high quality of interest if they now, just like you did for buying the victory bonds to win World War II that helped build up the war machine, which you had to do to fight fascists. Well, now you could do it for peacetime and do it to actually, you know, get in time. It'll be you have to be patient, right? But still, it'll be real payback for the individual, and the whole nation benefits at the same time. So you got a resolution to this dispute that's been lording over us for so long of like, well, are you for the Declaration of Independence or are you for the Constitution? Because the Declaration is all about the individual and the inalienable rights of the individual, whereas the Constitution is all about the general welfare in the preamble. And we know either one can be destructive if you leave one without the other. Like we're talking about the fakery or the problem of people who think only bottom up or only top down. It's like, well, if you go to just the general welfare, we could see all sorts of tyranny justifying doing evil for the greater good, and we'll misuse that power of the Constitution. And similarly, if you just think about everybody's individual rights with no sense of the greater whole, well, then you got, oh, you know, everybody just going for their own personal desires for license and what I want, with no consideration of the consequences of behavior on society as a whole, which can also, that's also capitalized upon by America's enemies and humanity's enemies, is playing both sides. So you want to get both to harmonize, and that requires thus, you know, a maturation of the culture where everybody starts seeing that their rights are associated with their responsibilities, that my right is not my freedom, and my rights are not there because I, you know, I have the freedom to buy whatever I want and gamble whatever I want. Because I could select whatever flavor of pizza, I have freedom. It's like, no, it's like the real freedoms are the things that come with responsibilities that were fought for, that you have to thus defend. And that relationship of duty and freedom, again, that's in philosophy schools today, they handicap students in philosophy to think that historic ancient problem of the freedom duty paradox is unresolvable. We live in an absurd universe where you can't live those can't live together. And it's like, no, if you think like Benjamin Franklin, you think like the founding fathers who bled and had the, you know, were willing to die for the idea of liberty. No, they were able to resolve it. They got it. They understood it. And Lincoln understood it. And you know, it's Martin Luther King Jr.'s the anniversary of his birth today. And, you know, you read his speeches, his sermons, and you look at what he did. He understood how to resolve it, but it requires becoming, you know, a bigger person than the type of mediocre slave type of identity that the oligarchy wants in their society, of people who just think about me versus everybody else, you know, or what do I get from the government? When am I going to get my universal, you know, my UBI, social credit, you know, when am I going to get that? Cause I want to buy my weed, you know, like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's the same on the micro level when it comes to, rugged individualism. And let's say you want to be self-sufficient and everything, but nobody's an island. Like, you can't do that without your surrounding community, right? So while you want this freedom and independence, if you're not simultaneously building a local community, you're not going to be able to individually achieve your goal. And it's a very same on the, you know, these macro ideas apply on the personal level. It's the exact same thing. Like, okay, yeah, I can acquire this land, I can develop this infrastructure, I can raise these animals, but there are always going to be deficiencies and holes in the bucket where communally, if you work together and it creates an economy, right, where you're exchanging, and now, well, for one, you don't have to do it all. So if you don't have to do it all, you don't have to be capable of doing it all. If you don't have to be capable of doing it all, that reduces your cost, that increases your time, you know. So it's the exact same thing on the micro level in these rural homestead type communities like the one we're involved in, where your individual listic and you want to be self-sufficient and you want to develop this infrastructure and you want to do all these things. But if you are willing and you understand your responsibility to your local community, right? And so you're willing to, well, I don't like to talk to people and I don't really want to talk to my neighbor, you know, because I can just go on Twitter and vent or whatever, you know, and yeah. And I can just blame all these politicians or whatever, and it's their fault and they ruined everything. No, if you'll reach out to your neighbor and say, hey, what are you doing over here? And how can I help? What do you need? Oh, I have this and I could contribute this. I could add value here. And they're like, oh, wow. Like, this is a real person. They're in close proximity and they can provide these goods and services. I have these goods and services, or maybe all I have is just really good ideas. Maybe I'm very good at solving problems and I can just consult them and say, hey, have you thought about this? Have you done this? And you're just creating a synergy as a community to resolve problems and build redundancy and to just make the load lighter for everyone. And I think it's kind of like the exact same concept, but on a much larger scale. And that's where the conversation has to go. And while we're having the conversation, we have to be actively kind of living that out in our own local community. And then when you're doing that in your local community, you can share ideas for these bigger picture items and work together collectively. Like, for example, in our area, there's this Marvin Nichols project. And what it is it's, you know, they want to steal about 2,000 acres. Or no, I'm sorry, 200,000 acres to create a reservoir. And a lot of that 200,000 acres has everything to do with mitigation. So the reservoir is only 6,300 acres or something, but they have to steal all this other surrounding properties to mitigate the loss of resources, whether it's timber, whether it's agriculture, and all these different things. And then what'll happen is they'll build this reservoir to supply Dallas with their urban drinking water. And meanwhile, they'll destroy all this rural infrastructure that everybody needs for meat production and for everything else. Meanwhile, there's very simple solutions like a salinization plant on the Gulf, you know, that could supply Dallas and everywhere else in the state of Texas, for that matter, that's easily scalable. You know, and these are the kind of things, right? These are the exact kind of topics where if you're just focused on your thing and I got mine and we got our cows, even though this Marvin Nichols thing could potentially, they could just come in and say, oh yeah, well, we like your property too, you know? And now you're like, oh, I've been I've been ignoring these larger issues and I've been focusing on all my stuff. And now because of this larger, arcing issue, I have nothing, you know. It's like, And that's why these topics are so important to discuss.
Absolutely,
because
dude.
All of this political stuff just it does affect all of us. And if you're going to just stay willing the ignorant to it, you could wake up and suffer the repercussions and the consequences. It's been really neat to see the local community come together at the last public meeting, and the place was packed out, you know, and our political representation was there, and we're definitely on the side of the people. So that was really encouraging, and we're seeing a lot of really good traction. But that's just a small illustration of kind of what we're talking about and why you do have to be aware, educated, and involved to push back against these things. Not just push back, say, no, we don't want you to do this, but, well, here are some solutions, you know, here are some ideas of what we can do instead. And it's looking like there's progress going in the right direction there. And that's why I think it's great to talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. Amen, brother. Amen. No, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, like you said, the amount of solutions to problems that shouldn't even be problems at this point, honestly, had we not abandoned our better traditions. Like, you know, I just published a piece on the North American Water and Power Alliance that JFK and Bobby Kennedy were advocating for and openly advocating for, which was just the most revolutionary thing. It would have completely given people a sense of like there's all these artificial dichotomies, right? Like one of those dichotomies that's really causing a lot of damage is this idea that human industry and human thought is anti-nature, so that when we build anything agro-industrially, it's always at the expense of this abstract idea of this perfect nature. That's this being, this Gaia in stasis, that's just, that we always destroy. And every time there's more of us, that's just more cancer, more pollution. Every baby's a pollution machine, right? Everything is destructive. And kids are fed this type of propaganda at a very early age in elementary schools. And it's really sick before you have critical thinking skills developed to be given that type of propaganda. It really can create a future eco-terrorist, frankly. And yeah. And we see it. It is creating eco-terrorists, frankly.
And it creates a lot of suicide, you know? It's just like, yeah. Oh, well, I'll help the cause. I'll just kill myself, and because I'm just a useless eater, you know?
Right. Yeah, and depression, climate depression. Like, I was working in a university for a couple of years, and they had on the bulletin boards little advertisements for the eco-psychiatrists. So if you're in climate depression, you can call up, you know, one of these climate psychiatrists to come and help you resolve your self-hating issues as a kid. It's like, that shouldn't be a thing. That shouldn't be an industry. That shouldn't be a job. That shouldn't be feelings that kids have. They should be proud to be humans who accomplish things for the benefit of our great grandkids. And the, you know, like that should be we should be proud to be humans who build things, and we should see our minds as a part of nature. Like, God created nature. Our mind is part of creation. It just so happens that our minds can do what my cat's mind can't do. It doesn't mean my cat, right, because it's inferior to humans in many ways, not in every way, but it doesn't make it bad. It doesn't make monkeys bad. It just means that we have capacities and powers that are not there. And that also comes with duties, because if we can discover the invisible laws of nature, the way animals can't discover, they act instinctually and it's cool for them. But, you know, their limits to growth are relatively constrained by their genetics, by the environment and its scarcity or abundance. They'll grow into the abundance, or they'll retract according to scarcity. And that's what they do. And they've been doing that for a long time. So human beings also, if we're thinking like animals, will encounter those same problems of adaption only, like in a Darwinian fight for survival. But if we're thinking like humans, not the law of the jungle, but real humans, then we're thinking about the future. We're allocating some of our food reserves to the side in case the seasonal drought is going to hit every 7 years. It's a story. It's in the Bible, right? And then we can build things that are going to stop the droughts from happening. You know, if we think big, if we develop technologies and skills, and that's part of nature too. And the periodic table is growing, and we've discovered there's over 2,000 isotopes, and we've created a bunch of transuranics through technologies that we've developed over the last century. And it doesn't mean that they're not natural. We just happen to be able to produce things and generate things that fall organically and lawfully on the periodic table beyond the uranium. And it's great because we're discovering new attributes that give us new powers, new capabilities to transcend limits to growth. And the oligarchy, they just despise that. The Keynesians, that's another thing I'll just say here.
Malthusians, yeah.
We were lied to about FDR being a Keynesian. That's another straight lie that I had to also overcome. Like, there was so much effort that's been put into our history rewriting narratives to convince Americans and Canadians that the Great Depression was solved because of John Maynard Keynes's theories. It was never true. It was always a lie. John Maynard Keynes despised FDR, and FDR despised John Maynard Keynes. FDR situated his intellectual understanding of political economy from the American system tradition of the Constitution, not from John Maynard Keynes, a lover of Malthus, of social Darwinism, of he was the head of, or the treasurer of the British Eugenic Society, world government. He was an enemy of FDR. And yeah, he had brainwashed ideologues positioned in to try to influence the New Deal, sure. But the New Deal it was not being shaped by his considerations at all. And after FDR died, probably poisoned, that's where you had the Keynesians of the John Kenneth Galbraiths out there that started taking control with the Fabian Society, the Roundtable Movement, of the Rhodes Scholars. They started taking control of those institutions like the UN, like Bretton Woods, the IMF, the World Bank. They started using them and co-opting them to become instruments of evil and empire instead of the type of instruments for development and collaboration that they were designed originally to be. So the oligarchy is good at perverting things that were created by humans, but they can't really create something new, fresh, that's somehow good. They could just pervert and corrupt things that were good, including individuals. So that gives me a bit of hope, but in the sense that they can't create. Only humans can create. And that's the challenge that we're currently facing today. And as you said, you know, there's desalinating water. You could do that. Small, medium modular reactors could be built up. There's a variety of ways to take that salt water, desalinate it, reverse osmosis, bring it in, solve the water crisis on a number of ways.
Is there a way to link that particular newsletter for on Breaking Wall Street? Is there a way that I can link that in the show notes?
Yeah, I'll send you a link. Sure.
Okay, awesome. So, y'all, if you're interested in the histrionics behind all of this, I'll link Matt's newsletter. It's a great newsletter. I highly recommend you sign up for that. As we're wrapping up, Matt, is there anything in closing, maybe just to wrap this up?
No, those sort of my final remarks that I was kind of just tied together there. So I guess if people want to, like I said, get the newsletter, yeah, that'll be in the description box. There's also books. So if people go to my website, CanadianPatriot.org, they'll find the Clash of the Two Americas book series. My new book series is just out as well, called, I just got a few author copies that just arrived in the mail, The Revenge of the Mystery Cults. So Mystery Babylon and the Age of Aquarius is volume one. Rosicrucian Golem there is volume two.
Does the Age of Aquarius talk about the transgender movement?
Oh yeah. Going back to the first transgender movement of the cult of Cybele and Attis that was managing the ancient Roman pantheon of mystery cults. And then the third one's on Edgar Poe's Final Mystery with Aleister Crowley there and Arthur Conan Doyle flanking a little weird gothic thing that people can read about. So those are all available on CanadianPatriot.org. And finally, RisingTideFoundation.net is that other educational website I was telling people about at the beginning.
So Matt's one of those guys that, like, if you're like, I wish I could know all the stuff that he's forgot, That's Matt. So I highly recommend you check out his information, the way that it's presented. The UFO series was awesome. I think it's very salient and pertinent in light of drones off of the eastern seaboard, and also in light of Sean Ryan's recent podcast. Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff, y'all, to think about. So it's always great. It's always great having you on. We'll have you back on. Appreciate your time, man. Thank you for all the heavy lifting you do. And it's been awesome, y'all. And so this is always brought to you by thetexasboys.com. So if you want to support the podcast, if you appreciate what we do, go on over to thetexasboys.com. Check out our new coffee line. If you're local and you're looking for some beef, we're doing that now with a local pickup where you can buy in smaller quantities. We're just trying to make it more readily available to people that don't eat three cows a year like us. So check that out. And we'll see y'all on the next stream.